It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we have a special show for you from New York City. Gourmet Magazine invited us to do a stage show to kick off their Gourmet Institute weekend, a gathering of experts of every stripe. Well, we got them together on the stage of the Museum of Television and Radio. Now, you're going to hear Gourmet Executive Editor John Willoughby talk the New York food scene with the city's Captain Ahab of chefs, David Pasternak. We're teaming the bad boy and the perfectionist, chefs Anthony Bourdain and Thomas Keller. Then it's two critics who have made many a chef squirm, Gail Green and Ruth Reichel. And we have the man who pioneered the new craze for impeccably aged cheeses, Ihsan Gerdel. All this coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's a Splendid Table field trip to New York City. Gourmet Magazine invited us to do a stage show to kick off their second annual Gourmet Institute weekend. Now, the Gourmet Institute is the weekend when the magazine throws open its doors to 300 participants. They round up every kind of star chef, critic, and expert to do seminars, 53 of them in 2 days. So we set up camp on the stage of the Museum of Television and Radio. We brought down the house lights, brought up the spotlights, and rolled. Our first duo to join us on stage was the magazine editor and the chef. One observes and interprets, and the other is in the trenches, cooking 12 hours a day. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. Chef David Pasternak was named Best Chef in New York City this year by the James Beard Foundation. His restaurant is Esca, where fish reigns supreme. We're joining them on stage. It's good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Yeah, John, I want to talk to you first about this weekend. How does a chef or a food person get selected to be part of this?
Well, we have to like them. No, it's
we made that cut.
Yeah, Dave made it. We like Dave, so he's one of them. We really looked around for people who exemplified the best in restaurants and in food in New York, who were at the top of certain trends, who were people whose food we really loved, who were great restaurateurs, who were great designers of restaurants, people who really were good at relating what they do to the public. So you can come in. We did keep it very small so that you're never going to be in a crowd of 300 people. You're going to be in a crowd of 20 people. So you can observe what they're doing, ask them questions, really learn from them. And so we were looking for people who are not only at the top of the food game, but also are good at teaching.
Okay. And so how does David fit into the mix?
How did
David make the cut?
Because his food is amazing, and he is a hands-on food person. Dave is actually out there fishing, catching fish. He knows about fish because he actually is acquainted with them as well as cooking them. So he's really exemplifies the hardworking chef who's in his kitchen and who's out there dealing with the products that he's about to cook.
Well, now, David, your restaurant is Esca, and you specialize in fish.
Yes.
What does Esca mean?
Esca means bait.
I love it.
All you need is the hook and the line.
Right, and you're off and running.
Squid is bait, right? Shrimp is bait. Depends where you live.
Now, I've heard you referred to as a cross between Captain Ahab and Jacques Cousteau.
Very good.
Where did this thing...
I'd rather be Ahab.
Hey, but he didn't end very well.
We all end up that way.
You do things with fish that, I mean, you started a fad there, didn't you?
That's what they're telling me.
Why don't you explain what it is?
Crudo. The idea actually came, I was in Trieste, which is in northern Italy, and with my business partner, and a friend of his took us into Croatia to this area. It's this little cove that was cut out by a fjord, it was cut out by a glacier, and there was a restaurant at the bottom, and we went there, and we ate this whole meal of just, like, raw fish, and I was like, wow, this is brilliant.
Was it, but it's not like sushi, is it? I mean, it's not quite as manipulated?
It's basically fish that's dressed with olive oil, sea salt, lemon, you know, we've evolved it a little bit with some condiments, but in Italy, it's pretty simple, you know, you have your basic varieties, you have scampi or langoustines, you have branzino, sea bass, you know, you have snapper, or amberjack,
and that's
the basic breakdown, and they do a little creativity, I mean, depending where you are, but at this place, it was just really straightforward, it was like outstanding olive oil, really good sea salt, really fresh fish.
You know what occurs to me, though? I mean, you're dealing, if you are serving raw fish, you have to, I mean, fish is so fragile. You have to be dealing with something that is in pristine condition and maybe has, I'm exaggerating, but a 45-minute, you know, I mean, there's a window
about
this big.
There's a responsibility.
Yeah, and I mean, how do you, first of all, how do you find it? And also, what do you do when you don't sell it all?
Well, I mean, you hope that you're going to be busy to answer that question first, that you're gonna sell it all that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, finding it is hard. As any good chef knows, to find a good product. I mean, you have to develop relationships. You have to look around. You know, we go to the fish market 5 days a week. I own a truck, so we buy from a lot of local fishermen. Mm-hmm. You know, people who live in this area forget that we have a tremendous amount of, you know, coastal area. You know, we have from Montauk all the way to here. So
you're actually going out and you know the fishermen and you're bringing...
Yeah, we actually buy a lot of stuff off of local boats. And, you know, right now we're running a lot of tuna. And, you know, the tuna, the guys, when they fish a tuna at night, when they bite during the day, they tuna don't bite. So they fish tilefish and they fish mahi-mahi. And so it's a whole cycle. That if you have the right connection, if you're buying a tuna from the guy, there's a good chance this time of year you're going to buy some tilefish, you're going to buy some mahi-mahi.
Otherwise, you don't get the tuna.
Guy caught a wahoo the other day.
What's a wahoo?
Wahoo is it's outstanding. They say it's one of the fastest fish in the ocean. And they call it wahoo because when you got it on the line, you go, wahoo!
That's their technical name.
Exactly.
He's a food writer, too, you know, so he's making notes.
Really?
He's making notes. You know, I'd like to step back, John, and look at the food scene in New York, because you're both involved in it in a different way. You're out there producing every night, David and John, as the editor of a national magazine, and you've written about food for the New York Times and for other national publications. Where's the inspiration coming from now in New York? What do you think's influencing
product?
Chefs? Product?
I go to the farmer's market. I go to the fish market. You know, I go out fishing. You know, you never know what you're going to catch. I went the other day to a really interesting tasting of heritage animals. I mean, breeds that were popular before the 50s and mm-hmm. before mass market agriculture bought out all the American farms, and I thought that was really interesting. Chickens with only dark meat, you know, turkeys where the breasts are real small and the legs are big. So, I mean, it's
real flavor differences, too. I would
completely
imagine.
Different.
Guys, one thing I think is real, I mean, there's a new restaurant which is actually a little outside of New York, and it's not a restaurant that a lot of people are going to fully emulate because you need like a huge amount of money to do it.
Uh-huh.
It's Blue Hill at Stone Barns, where it's a completely self-sufficient restaurant. They raise all their own pigs and chickens and all, not only their vegetables, but their meat as well. And it's funded by the Rockefellers, so it's like it's really got a lot of money behind it. But it is an interesting development. It's a restaurant as a self-sufficient entity, a restaurant as a learning place where you learn about sustainability and all the other things that people are excited about now, in addition to having great food. So I think it's going to be influential in terms of influencing the way mm-hmm. restaurants try to deal with those issues.
Which circles back to this concept of product.
Right.
Where it comes from. David Pasternak, John Willoughby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Pasternak is chef of ESCA. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and head of the Gourmet Institute. Our next guests on stage were two more chefs from two very different extremes, the consummate perfectionist and the food world's most famous bad boy. The perfectionist is Thomas Keller. Now, he and his restaurant, The French Laundry in California, are constantly being named best chef and best restaurant in the country. Now, he recently came to New York to open an East Coast version of The French Laundry. He calls it Per Se. Well, the bad boy was who else but Chef Anthony Bourdain, one of the food world's most gifted writers and cooks, the author of Kitchen Confidential, and now out with his first cookbook, Anthony Bourdain's Layal Cookbook. Well, when Tony and Thomas walked on stage, the audience greeted them like rock stars.
I have two tall, rangy men up here, and they are just, I'm going to embarrass you. God, you guys are gorgeous.
Thank you. We love it, too.
No, but I mean, talk about, you know, we always talk about that dinner party you'd have where you can invite anybody from any time or whatever. Well, you two are on my list. I would love an evening of a lot of good wine and a lot of good food and just letting you guys go, letting you rip.
What happens after?
Thomas, it's a family show. And my husband's listening. No, how do you you each see each other? I'd be curious, because you are both, no, you both have achieved a tremendous amount of celebrity. You both work in very specific areas. Thomas, how do you see Tony Bourdain?
Well, you know, I love Tony. I love the way he writes. I love his passion. But most of all, I love his honesty about what we do and where we came from and how far we've actually come in the past two decades, three decades as an industry and as chefs in particular and as cooks. And it's really an accurate history.
All the rough and tumble in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. As much as some of us don't want to admit it, I mean, that's yeah. kind of where we came from.
Yeah.
You know, how much can you do? You know, how many cigarettes can you smoke? How many beers can you drink? At the same time, you're putting out 300 dinners for whoever. It's really a physical thing.
Yeah, yeah. Tony, how about you? How do you see Thomas?
Well, I'm going to embarrass Thomas, but I think he's the guy. I think he's the best chef in America and possibly the world. Certainly the best meal I've ever had, you know, with a white tablecloth has been at the French Laundry in Napa Valley. I see him as a guy who... is practicing the art of cooking at its very highest level, and yet has never lost sight of the importance of soulfulness, of having a sense of humor, of context, of all the other important elements in a great meal, and it's one of the things that really distinguishes him from you know other. Three-star Michelin chefs, for instance.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, makes him better.
Can I hug him?
You can hug him. Go ahead. Hug him. Hug him. I love to know how people come to do what they do, because I think most people in the food business, most of them did not start out to do what they ended up doing with most of their lives. Now, Tony... you're a writer and a very gifted one, and I think you've been writing most of your life, right?
Absolutely wrong.
Ah, all right, okay.
I started very, very late in life. I would never have been able to become a writer had I not become a fairly useful cook and professional restaurant person. I mean, the same ethic that any good qualities I have, any good work ethic that I might have, any stories, any voice. Uh-huh. All of that came directly from my first job as a dishwasher and my long, slow progress up the ladder in restaurants. I mean, I really started writing in 95, 96, failed spectacularly initially, forgot all about it, and then on the basis of an obnoxious over-testosterone memoir, you know my name.
That was Chef Anthony Bourdain, author of Kitchen Confidential. Now, we're going to be back with more of Anthony and his fellow chef, Thomas Keller, in a moment. We're bringing you a show we recorded in front of a live audience at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. We're bringing you a special show that we taped in New York City at the Museum of Television and Radio as an opening act to Gourmet Magazine's Gourmet Institute Weekend. 2 days of demos and seminars featuring the food world's elite, a very verbal group of movers and shakers. Now, when we last checked in, we were in mid-interview with two of America's most famous chefs, Kitchen Confidential author Anthony Bourdain and Thomas Keller, chef of the French Laundry and the newly opened Per Se. Now, we're joining them back on stage, talking to Anthony about how he got started in the business. How did you first get that job as the dishwasher? I mean, what got you into the restaurant as opposed to?
I was a rotten kid. I didn't have any respect for anyone else. I had no respect for myself. My roommates got sick of me loafing on vacation, and they got me a summer job washing dishes. Mm-hmm. And I looked around and I said, for various reasons, I like this business. I like this lifestyle. I want to be a member of this tribe. It was the first time that I went home with something to feel proud about. It was the first bunch of people I met whose respect was important to me. I went home feeling like a champion. I was a very happy dishwasher. And just the cooks got, you know, more free liquor and better girls.
Now it comes down to it. But I think that makes a great deal of sense because the rewards sometimes are not the ones that you're told you should be looking for.
The love of food snuck up on me. The pride in my profession, all of that came later. I fell in love with the lifestyle first.
Mm-hmm. Now, Thomas, you didn't set out to go to restaurant school. How did you come to food?
My mother. How do we all come to food? My mother ran restaurants when I was a child, and it was something that, as being the youngest of five boys, she was back in her career, and I would go to the restaurant after school because that's where my mother was. And she would set me in front of the dishwasher, and I thought it was such a fascinating thing. You put something in that was dirty, and 30 seconds later, it came out clean. This was an amazing thing to a young boy. So growing up in that back of the house role was something that I always did. Even though when I graduated from high school and going on to college, I really didn't want to be involved in the restaurant business. But of course, there was job security there. My mother wouldn't fire me.
Yeah.
And eventually, the chef cook, the one man guy was leaving. It was a private club, and she said, you know, watch what he does for the next 2 weeks, and you can have his job. And I said, wow, that's really interesting. And that's kind of what happened.
Had you ever cooked?
Not really, no.
But I understand you would call your brother?
I would call my brother, who's 18 months older than I was, who was actually, you know, in a career path to become a chef. And if I needed to have any kind of opinion or any kind of direction at all, Joseph would give that to me at that time. And then realizing after 2 years in that role that it was something that I started to really, again, like, because you could see results. You knew when you put something in the pan how it was going to come out. Mm-hmm. And then that instant gratification, that instant satisfaction about performing a certain task and seeing the results almost immediately was something that I really kind of embraced and I enjoyed very much. And the group of us decided one summer just to all take off. And the other great thing about being in the restaurant industry is you can go anywhere you want and get a job. So we all headed to Newport, Rhode Island for the tall ships and the Bicentennial, and ended up working there. I went back the following year, and that's when I met a gentleman who became my mentor. And he was the one that really kind of made the connection for me. It was an emotional connection about cooking.
This?
His name
Who
was Roland Hennen, and he was working at the Dunes Club in Narragansett, Rhode Island. But he made that connection. It was about really giving to somebody else something that was so basic, but also could be so pleasurable and really bring that instant gratification, satisfaction of doing the function, bringing it full circle. Mm-hmm. And watching somebody enjoy that.
Yeah, I know both of you. You've mentioned your mother. And Thomas, in your first cookbook, The French Laundry, the first paragraphs of the introduction talk about your mother, but something that had me curious. You say your mother taught you to clean house.
Right.
And that was a very important part of how you became whatever you are now.
Neurotic.
But how did your mother play into this? Obviously she gave you a first job.
It was the repetition. It was, again, being a cook is about, everybody has this view of it's a glamorous lifestyle. Really, it's about repetition, to be able to do the same thing day in and day out and be challenged by that, mm-hmm. which is very important, and try to do it better than you did it yesterday. And certainly as a young child, we had, as all the brothers, we all had our chores to do you know, mine was cleaning the bathroom and how to do that in a way that was, you know, every week. It had, and that was my chore. I had to do it. So I had to find some compelling, some challenging aspects about it and how to do it better each day. And I think those work ethics of repetition was something that I really got from my mother. And worked, again, it was all coincidence, but it played right into being a cook.
And what about you, Anthony? How is your mother? Has your mother played in your career?
My mother cooked well, and both parents sort of insisted on shoving my brother and myself into eating well and widely. And that certainly resonated later on when I found myself in the business and that moment when I started to realize I liked it. But I have to kind of echo what Thomas is saying, that this sense of order, repetition, order, it seems sadly lacking in the lives of so many people who come to the restaurant business, and yet we find in the restaurant business the only order that the order that we need, perhaps, the only kind of order that we would accept. As you probably know, the kind of personalities who are attracted to the restaurant business are fairly uncontrollable, often outside of the restaurant business. But for whatever reason, that the hierarchy, the repetition, the instant gratification, the control systems, those are all very comforting for some reason to many of us.
Both of you have traveled a long path. You both started out cooking in kitchens, and you've both reached international celebrity in different ways. But it's still the core of it is what happens on a plate in different ways. How do you, it's a philosophical question, but how essentially do you keep that core that initially started all of this, that core that keeps you going? I write, and when the writing is really going well, when I've gotten out of my own way, I almost envision like a river running from my stomach. It's an interesting part of the anatomy, but it's this flow. And I want to know is, how do you stay in touch with that? With four restaurants and, you're on both coasts and cookbooks and celebrity and you with an incredible success, Tony, with your books, TV, and restaurants.
Well, in my case, I'm working in a very, very narrow classic genre. I run a brasserie, almost no original recipes in the cookbook or at the restaurant. This is probably the type of food I should have been cooking my whole life. I'm very comfortable with it. I think food at its best always is an expression of a personality, a culture, a region, even a time. Mm-hmm. This is mine. I think it would be an egregious error if I were to start trying to become an artist. I'm not. I'm a journeyman chef, and I'm working in a classic model that mirrors my temperament and where I came from and what I love and who I am.
I would never call you a journeyman anything.
I run a turn and burn steak free, brasserie.
Okay.
We're about volume.
And Thomas, I think of you and I think of pristine white plates and food that's been, all the extras have been eliminated. But again, where's the well? How do you keep that coming?
Well, for me, it's about the camaraderie, a lot of it, and the collaboration that we have as cooks, but not only as cooks, but as people in the restaurant, whether you're in the kitchen or in the dining room. It's that camaraderie, it's that teamwork, it's that knowing that as you bring everything together, you begin at 5:30 in the morning and, working for one moment at, to begin at 5:30 at night, mm-hmm. and sometime throughout that night that's going to come together for you, or every time, it depends. But it's, for me, it's being with the group, it's being with the people.
But now your staff is spread around the country because you have Per Se in New York, you have French Laundry in California, and you're also in Las Vegas. How does that exchange happen now?
I miss them desperately. This is something that this is the next challenge. How can we communicate and how can we collectively collaborate on things that we want to work on? That is our challenge. And as I was saying earlier, it may take a while, but at some point it'll become evident to me in the way we're going to collaborate together to bring back that collective team effort that was so wonderful when we were all together at the French Laundry. Remember, the staff that's in Vegas or at Per Se was a staff that was, we were all together at French Laundry for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And we do miss each other desperately. We talk on the phone and we email one another, but it's that spontaneous idea, that spontaneous moments of sitting around at 1 o'clock in the morning having a glass of wine and throwing out an idea on the table and having the person next to you come up with something else. And it's really about being cooks. It's not about being a chef or being a leader at that moment. It's just about a bunch of people sitting around talking about food.
Yeah. What's going to happen if?
Yeah.
I just like to say that the greatest thing about, touch on something Thomas said, that I think one of the greatest things about being in this business is that in the world of chefs and cooks, there are only 2 degrees of separation. We all know each other, or we know somebody who knows somebody. And the camaraderie, as mm-hmm. you travel more and more in a very increasingly transient business where people do stages and apprenticeships around the world, you know, you bump into people you know and mutual friends. It's like being in a mafia. It's great.
Tony, do you think people are born to cook?
No, I think you can be born to eat well. You can come from a culture where eating is important, where everybody around you takes food seriously, and where dining or eating is a mm-hmm. joyous central experience to a family or a culture. Cooks are made. I love that. I quote the Jean-Louis Paladin story where some credulous journalist is asking Jean-Louis Paladin, you know, oh, Jean-Louis, you know, when did you decide to become a chef? You know, why did you decide to become a chef? You know, I guess assuming that he would answer, oh, I was always, from infancy, I dreamed of white truffles and sea urchins redolent of the sea and, you know, wild mushrooms and smelling of peat and deep forest. In fact, he turned around and said, Madame, my parents sold me into slavery. So it happens to you.
Yeah, and also, you've talked about in your books the real world of who is cooking that elegant, you know, the French food or the fusion or whatever in that kitchen is not necessarily somebody who was feasting on white truffles.
The entire restaurant industry in the United States would collapse overnight without the Mexicans and Ecuadorians who came here with no cooking experience whatsoever mm-hmm. and started as our dishwashers and porters. It's one of the things I just loathe about the Beard House. You go to the Beard Awards and you look out, and it's like you haven't seen so many white people since the last George Wallace ran for president. Glad I got that off my chest. It's been cooking a long time.
I sense that, and I'm glad for you. I want to get a picture of how both of you work. So here's the setup. It's Friday night. You're in the middle of the worst part of the rush. I walk into your kitchen. Thomas, what would be my first impression?
Well, hopefully you're impressed with what you see. Hopefully that, you know, we're professionals of what we do. We've been doing it for a long time. You're going to walk into our kitchen, wherever it is, whether it's French Laundry, Bouchon, or Per Se, and be impressed in an inspiring way. And what I mean by that is looking at a group of people that are collectively working together for a common goal, not just in the kitchen, but in the entire restaurant.
Uh-huh. Is it noisy? I mean, is it?
It shouldn't be noisy. No. We try to keep the chaos. I mean, you've heard it before. It's controlled chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. I mean, chefs are control freaks, are they not, Tony? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the root of who we are. But you don't want to have a situation where it's chaos in the kitchen. No.
Layal, Friday night.
Slightly more civilized at Thomas. Okay, Friday night. Well, I'm cursing affectionately. Affectionately. Mm-hmm. I'm probably on my second margarita. They're playing Mexican hardcore over by the grill station. Mm-hmm. The busboys are squeezing behind me. It looks chaotic, but the food is coming up. It's going out on time. It's going to the right customers. It's properly cooked, and we're not getting any plates. No, there are no returns coming back from the floor. So it is about control, but it's two very different control systems. Mm-hmm. I tend to foster a us versus them mentality in the kitchen that I find very useful in you know, team spirit. You know, it's the Das Boot principle of restaurant management. Team building, I think they call it.
But the result's the same. I think that's the important thing. So there's many ways to get to the to a successful result.
We have slightly lower standards.
Tony Bourdain, Thomas Keller, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chef author Anthony Bourdain is executive chef of Layal Restaurant in New York. His newest book is Anthony Bourdain's Layal Cookbook. Thomas Keller is chef owner of the French Laundry in California and Per Se in New York City. His latest cookbook is Bouchon. Well, next on the docket for us were two of the lustiest and smartest people in the food business, two restaurant critics. Novelist and food writer Gail Green has been the insatiable critic for New York Magazine since 1968. She's more famous in the city than most of the restaurants she reviews. Ruth Reichel now heads Gourmet Magazine, but before Gourmet, Ruth was food editor and restaurant critic for the LA Times, then came east to be restaurant critic for the New York Times. We join them on stage. It is so good to see you both, and Gail, to see you without a hat.
Well, it's radio.
It's radio. It's radio. Gail has never been photographed, from what I understand. Am I right?
Right. Practically never without a hat.
Now, Gail, you've been critiquing with New York Magazine and also writing for other publications, but you've been critiquing since 1968. But I understand that your first book before that was Sex and the College Girl. Now, the connection to me seems pretty obvious, but just out of curiosity, how did you go from writing about sex to writing about food?
Well, I always thought that exactly the same senses are used to appreciate both food and sex. And when I first started to write about food and wanted to be able to explain to people the joy that I took in food, because at that time in New York City, foodies did not exist. People were much less passionate about food. It was not a common thing, and I wanted to explain how you could get so excited about food. And I thought they understood already a little bit about sex, and that if I could explain to them,
so you started us
similar kind of sensuality.
So you started us where we knew we were, and then we could move us forward.
Right, exactly.
Now, Ruth, you were actually cooking professionally, weren't you? How did you come into restaurant critiquing?
Well, sort of professionally. I mean, I started out actually writing a cookbook because I couldn't get a job. And everybody said to me, you're such a good cook, you ought to write a cookbook. So there I was, 21 years old, wrote this cookbook. And
what was the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you two are a great team.
You really are. You know, nobody told me at the time. I was 21 years old. I'm living in New York City. And it was sort of a hippie cookbook. All my friends did art. We were living in a loft on Rivington Street. And nobody said to me, people are going to be embarrassed to go into bookstores and say, can I have a copy of Mmm? So I was really surprised when it didn't sell a lot of copies.
You're listening to Ruth Reichel and Gail Green talking restaurant criticism on stage at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. Now, we're going to be back with more of Ruth and Gail and the country's first affineur. Don't worry, we're going to explain that in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. You're listening to a program that we recorded in New York City on stage at the Museum of Television and Radio, part of Gourmet Magazine's Gourmet Institute, a weekend devoted to demos and seminars by the city's food experts of every stripe. Now, with me on stage were two restaurant critics, New York Magazine's legendary Gail Green, and the former critic for the New York Times and now head of Gourmet Magazine, Ruth Reichel. We're joining Ruth talking about how her career began. But from there, you actually went to cooking?
But then we moved out to Berkeley, and I started a restaurant with a bunch of people. We were a collective. We made all of our decisions. Everybody had to vote on them. And
you mean on the cooking, too?
On everything. You know, if you wanted to change the soup, we had to have a meeting to see whether it would be acceptable. But, I mean, so to call it a professional experience would probably be sort of an exaggeration. I mean, I had worked as a waitress for many years in real restaurants, and I certainly knew the difference between the line where and the chef who's getting drunker and drunker and swearing at you as the night goes on, and our, you know, very politically correct restaurant.
Now, how did you come to the critiquing?
Oh, well, because I had written this cookbook, people thought I was a writer. And so when we moved to Berkeley, I did get some work actually writing for New West Magazine, which was the sister publication to New York Magazine. Uh-huh. And, you know, Gail was the sort of princess on the hill. We all sort of, you know, imagined that someday if we were very lucky, we would aspire to New York Magazinehood. And one of my editors ate my restaurant every night. And one day, I was not writing about food, I was writing about other things. And one day he just sort of looked at me and said, you know, you're a much better writer than our restaurant critic, and you can cook. Have you thought about doing restaurant reviews? Well, you know, we're making $1 an hour working in the restaurant, living in a group home. And the idea that somebody was going to give me free meals was heaven, just heven. I said, so sure, seductive. I would really like this job.
So that's how it started.
So that's how it started.
And you eventually ended up as restaurant critic for the LA Times. That was before you came here.
Yeah, I wrote for New West. I mean, they gave me a test drive. The most embarrassing thing about that was I had a Volvo that actually started with a screwdriver. So driving up and giving this to the valet was something.
Gail, was the free...
I sort of had a similar experience. I mean, I was a journalist. I was a newspaper reporter, and I was freelancing. And I got a phone call from Clay Felker, who had just started New York Magazine. And he said, we would like you to be our restaurant critic. And I said, oh, restaurant critic? I never thought about that. Well, what will you tell people are my credentials? And he said, well, aren't you a food person? I said, well, I've eaten around. And he said, but I can't afford to write for New York Magazine because I hear you're paying this tiny little fee for each story until you start to make money. And I'm making huge money writing for Ladies Home Journal and Cosmopolitan. And maybe I'll do a piece every 3 or 4 months. And he said, oh, no, the restaurant critic has to write every 2 weeks, he said. And people are begging to be the restaurant critic so they can charge all their meals to us. And I said, oh. I thought, oh, my God.
I was living in New York when you started writing for New York Magazine. And this is what I remember, going back to the physical aspect. I mean, you burst on the scene like a firecracker. Nobody was talking about food the way you did. And we had very good food writers, but nobody was having me panting by the time I got to the second paragraph. Did you actually do that consciously? I mean, was this one of the ways you tried to separate yourself?
No, I just think that Craig Claiborne, who was the authoritative voice, was very gentlemanly, and mm-hmm. he was also very passionate about food.
Oh, yes.
And of course, I, you know, in the beginning, he was God to me, and I just wanted to do what he did and looked for someone to pay some of the expenses. So, I just said who's there and why and what's going on and how it felt and how it smelled and how it looked. And then one day I tasted something and I said, oh, I know what's wrong with this. So I was able to criticize, and after that I just never stopped.
And so you are still doing this.
Right. Yes. So I don't think it was deliberate that I wanted to pile it all into that very tiny space.
Right.
And it wasn't just about the food. It was about the feel of the place and who was there and maybe a little dialogue. I love the kind of stories that Ruth tells, and it really tells you a lot about a restaurant, that are there.
But you're both, each in your own way, storytellers in your reviews. And you both do something that not many writers pull off, because it's not interesting. You use I. And a lot of times a writer uses it, and we don't care. But was this, again, conscious?
Well, I have to say, with using I, for me, was very important, because one of the things that I have always objected to about food writing is the notion that there's some objective standard. I mean, you really have to keep reminding your readers, this is what happened to me. I mean, I'm not sure that this is what's going to happen to you. So for me, it was very important.
Well, and in the early days, I did not reveal that I was a woman. Very consciously, for the first few years at New York Magazine, there was nothing in any of my reviews that revealed I was a woman, because there was quite a bit of prejudice against women writers at that time. And I remember when I met the famous critic, Roy de Groot, a very imposing man, and we were doing a radio show. And he said, oh, you're that little housewife who's writing writing restaurant reviews for New York Magazine.
Did you club him?
I was so upset. No, I didn't say a word during the entire show. I was so intimidated. But then, actually, when I separated from my husband, I thought, gee, maybe I should start advertising here. Let people know that I'm this juicy woman and I love to eat out. And so
did it work, Gail? Did it work?
Oh, yes. I began to get letters. I got letters from women saying, would I take their husbands to dinner on their birthdays? It was their fantasy to have dinner with me.
So did you ever do it?
Well, sometimes, yes.
Ruth, you talk about Gail was the princess of the hill. I mean, she was the epitome.
But we never met until much later.
No, not for years and years and years.
Well, how did it feel? I mean, you came from Los Angeles here to be the critic of the New York Times, which was no small shakes. I mean, how did it feel coming into Gail's territory?
Well, just coming to New York altogether was, I felt very provincial. I mean, I'd been in California for 20 years, and food was taken much more seriously here. And, of course, Gail had this amazing way of writing such delicious, sensual copy. But I also knew I had my own style. I mean, and what I did was very different than what Gail did, and very different from what the New York Times had been doing all along. And to be honest, I was much more frightened about what the readers of the New York Times, who had been used to this very staid, reasoned, august kind of reviewing.
What was it like for you, Kit?
Well, I was nervous too. Now, I thought people were very interested in hearing what a California voice had to say, and it was fresh and new. And I think they were particularly impressed when you did your brilliant review of Le Cirque, where you gave it one star for when you were not known, and was it three or four?
No, three.
Three stars for when you were known.
She went dressed dressed very simply, not fashionably, and then went in.
Yeah, I went in disguise once, and very unknown, and was treated very badly, and then went back. Didn't make the reservation in my own name, but it was my eighth visit, so by then I knew that he would know who I was, and it was just, all I had to do was write the two reviews, put them side by side and say, here's the difference. And, you know, the important thing about that was that people felt that I was on their side. You get a much more sympathetic reading.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the mail that came in the early days when I was busy trying to get a table in the fancy French restaurants and being abused, I was from readers who were similarly treated, and it was just incredible for them to have that kind of revenge. One of the most wonderful things about being a restaurant critic is to have a terrible meal and to know you're going to have the last word.
And to know it's going to be great copy.
Ruth, Gail, thank you so much.
Gail Green writes for New York Magazine, national publications, and is writing her memoir, Insatiable. Ruth Reichel heads Gourmet Magazine and is editor of the new gourmet cookbook, 60 Years of Gourmet Recipes. Well, at this point in the evening, I'd talked with editors, chefs, and critics. But there is another person who walks this tightrope in the food world of how to please and tease us. It's the purveyor. Now, my next guest came to food from an unexpected direction. He's a former Turkish Olympian turned Harvard volleyball coach, and then he became America's first affineur. İhsan Gürtel is the creator of Boston's Formaggio Kitchen, one of the country's most respected cheese shops. İhsan, welcome.
And you brought food. You brought, oh, bless you. I was getting very hungry. But would you explain what it is to be an affineur? Because I don't think people know what this is.
Some people make it very mystical, but it's very simple. It's basically taking really good care of cheese and picking the right cheese and bringing it to the public at the optimal point of that product. So taking care of it, flipping it, rubbing it, kissing it, spraying it with alcohol, turning it, cleaning the cheese mites, it's a lot of work.
But this is essentially the process of aging the cheese, right?
Exactly.
Or bringing it to full ripeness.
Bringing it to the right point.
Yeah.
Or what the producer intended the flavor to be. And getting it to that point to the end user is the key thing.
And this has done a great deal in France.
It's done a great deal in France, Italy, Spain, England, all the countries that are big in cheese.
So people from across the ocean, for instance, will send you cheeses that are essentially new, and instead of aging them themselves or ripening themselves, you will do that for them?
Sometimes. But most of the time, my effort would go into finding a product that's not quite, but almost ready to be consumed, because it takes us a while, almost 3 weeks, to get the product across.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the quantities that we bring in, nobody assumes that you're going to immediately sell it in optimal. On my last trip, I had to spend about 2 hours with one of the cheeses I brought you tonight. He wanted to know exactly when I wanted to sell the cheese, so he would pick the perfect wheel for Thanksgiving. So that kind of a foresight or projection is key.
This is almost high art.
Well, sometimes with some producers.
Now, what did you bring?
I brought you a Parmigiano Reggiano that I actually picked and will be serving the holiday season, and a Conte that we're serving right now.
Well, for those of you who don't know, Parmigiano Reggiano is one of the cheeses I dream about nightly and have for many years.
Just to make a point of it, this is an amazing Parmigiano Reggiano. It's Farm 1470. Every farm has a number.
Yes.
And Giorgio Crevero is the family that I work with. He controls three farms. This was one of the first families that sent cheeses to Manhattan in the 1850s.
Oh my.
In a schooner.
Do you know the names of the cows? It sounds like there's such a deep and intimate involvement.
This is a very small farm, 1470. They make about 5 wheels a day.
Could we taste?
Absolutely.
My tongue is hanging out. I love this, that a man pulls out of his pocket an immaculately clean penknife and just opens it. He's done this many times, you can tell. Now, oh my.
Yeah, no, this is
amazing.
It
smells like cream and sweet.
I mean, it's sweet.
Yeah.
It's not sour, and it's not overly sweet. So no. This is what the Italians call... I have to try this one.
Yeah. It's like this big flower has opened up in my mouth. It's
exactly.
Like I can taste its scent. Wonderfully sensual.
That's very key.
Now, tell me about the next one.
The next one... I'm actually the only one that brings these cheeses into U.S., Farm 1470 and the next one. That's Farm 908 in the Haute Jura. And I have to deal with these very serious French cheesemongers. And there's one genre of cow, which is called Montbéliard. It's very controlled. And they make a cheese called Conte, which is basically like Gruyère. And Claude is the head cheesemonger. And what they do to you, they put you under pressure. They literally profile you, and they try to find out how serious you are, as the French would say, sérieux. is this guy worth dealing with, or is he just a schmuck and we shouldn't waste time with it? So it took me about 3 years to get into the presence of these guys. And then they made it very clear to me the first time that I would not be doing business with them. This was completely just to see how good I am. You know, am I worthy? So on this trip, I think bringing my wife, having a female presence, made things much easier. You know, Claude said things I've never heard him say. He was like saying, I'm going to take you to a really good cheese right now. And like before then, it was never, they would stop in front of a wheel. You take a piece out with the cheese plug, and he gives you a piece, and then four or five of them start looking at you. They're like, hey, whatever I say, it's going to be wrong. If I keep my mouth shut, they're not going to take me seriously, so you gamble. But this time it was much more gentler.
Speaking of all this tasting, I don't mean to be rude. I'm fascinated, but now I cannot wait. Because I realized I would never be worthy of Claude.
And the cheese you're tasting is October 2002.
Which, so again, a two-year-old.
Again, a two-year-old, and this is extremely limited. I have to basically beg and bargain, and I'm in competition with the French cheesemongers. So I'm the bottom of the totem pole in this.
Now this tastes so different from the Parmigiano, but it has one thing in common with it. The flavor keeps changing in the mouth. It keeps evolving. It's very big. The very first moment, it reminded me of a Swiss cheese, but then it left Emmentaler behind in the dust. I mean, what I'm getting now is nuts and fruit.
Tropical fruit.
Yeah, I mean, just
hazelnuts. Mm-hmm. I mean,
did you get a walnut? Tell me the truth. Did you get a walnut?
I got hazelnuts on this one.
Okay. I got a walnut.
But for example, the same farm, November, which we have, mm-hmm. tastes like smoked beef.
And this is the man who
same
said...
Same animals, same farm.
This is the man who said, this is for November and
right.
This is for December.
Right.
Ihsan, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Ihsan Gertel is the proprietor of Formaggio Kitchen Cheese Shop in Boston. Well, that's our show from New York City. Thanks for joining us today. And special thanks to Gourmet Magazine and the Gourmet Institute for being such great hosts, as well as the folks at the Museum of Television and Radio. Have a great weekend, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from that grand dame, Mae West. She said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. You can register for it right on the site, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Nick Kyriakis recorded our show in New York with help from Rob Christensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke, and our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
American Public Media.